Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Well, I'm delighted now to be joined in the studio by author Colm Tobin. Lovely to have you with us.
Hi, good morning.
You're here with this lovely new book, Ship in Full Sail, which we're going to talk about. But I have to ask you first, any interest in being president yourself?
Yeah, I really would. I'm like everyone in Ireland has an inner president. People feel that I could be the one who would receive the ambassadors and make the speeches. I think there are a million people in Ireland who have some feeling if only they would notice me. I could be president. And there are obviously some people running as candidates, not this time perhaps, but the last time. Mm-hmm. But you feel we're in that million and should have stayed there. But the thing is, I would come seventh. You know, first I'd have to ask the county councils to get me the nomination. And that's tough. You have to go around the country. You're up to Donegal and places. But I'd ask Wexford County Council to give me the nomination.
Oh,
but I would come seventh. And coming seventh in an Irish presidential
election. You don't
election,
want that.
Even my transfers would be useless to people. Yeah, but there wouldn't be enough of them.
Do you know, it's been quite slow to start. People have been very shy about coming forward. Is that a sad state of affairs?
Yeah, I think, you see, the presidential thing is really about vision and it's about some idea of the spirit of the nation. But in an election campaign, you're being asked bread and butter questions. And that was the last time, 7 years ago, there was an RTE thing with David McCullough. And David was doing his job. He was asking them questions about their own records.
Yes.
And he was sort of almost accusing some of them of various little things. And they were trying to talk vision. So it's quite a difficult thing to present yourself. People are fed up with rhetoric and people talking high talk. But that's what the president is. So I don't know how you do a presidential debate. Because letting them blather and letting them go on with nonsense. But maybe that's the best way to do it and see which is the least offensive.
It's a tricky one, but I suppose essentially people just want to know who this person is,
yeah.
Don't they? They just want to get a little look inside under the bonnet.
It is Mary McAleese, because it was a very short campaign and a lot of people didn't know her. And in 6 weeks, she managed to make people realise who she was and how good she would be. So that's open to be done. Someone can come basically from left field, from as an outsider, and people could end up thinking, well, she's a lawyer, she's articulate, she seems incredibly nice, and that's Mary McAleese.
Well, that could happen yet, you see,
one. Yeah,
yeah. You know,
we're
not there yet.
If I were a county councillor, I'd be raging I hadn't been asked yet to nominate someone.
But they will be asked,
and since
I'm sure.
The power is there, I think they really should do it. That's my view. But coming seventh is never any fun in one of those things.
That's not where you don't want to be. Listen, this book, which I said, it's beautiful. I have it in my hands and I was lucky enough to have it over the weekend. Ship in Full Sail, born of your time as the Laureate for Irish Fiction. When they said to you, would you do a blog? And you said, what's that?
Yeah. I mean, the thing about a blog is who reads a blog and how long is a blog? You see, a newspaper column is always determined by the newspaper. But a blog, you're halfway through a blog and you think, I have much more to say. And you're just, no one is going to stop me going on. Now, if anyone in Ireland says, everyone in Ireland thinks they should write a book. I mean, it's like being president. And there are a million people who think they should write a book. And but they haven't time. Now, this is proof that that's wrong. Because I wrote a blog every month for 3 years. And overall, I now have this book, which is quite a big size. And so that's how you write a book. If you have trouble, if you think you don't have time, every month, 2,000 words. 2,000 words, would really, it's a weekend of every month.
Mm-hmm.
And after 3 years, you'll have a book. So that's what this is.
What were you saying to yourself when you were sitting down to write these blogs? Were you focused on what you saw the job as the laureate of being? Or were you just thinking, well, this, I have great freedom. I can write about whatever I want.
Well, I didn't really have great freedom because it was going to be on the Arts Council website. So
oh, yeah, you couldn't say what you wanted.
Well, it couldn't be political. In other words, it couldn't be a week in, week out attack on the government. And that freed me. In a way, to try and write about things that might matter for longer, books I was reading, paintings I was looking at, general views I had on things to do with, I suppose, life, art. And so it gave me a sort of greater freedom, the fact that I didn't have to attack the minister.
Yes.
And I could do memoir 1 week. I could, you know, just decide I was back in the Mater Hospital suffering from cancer and what was that like? Or I could talk about Joyce. Or I could talk about Enniscorthy. And so it was great freedom, the freedom, you know, because I couldn't really write about politics, the freedom to actually try and find another subject that I thought might matter more.
I liked Father and Son a lot. I like the description of Beckett's relationship with his dad, which sounded beautiful. And then I wondered about your relationship with your father, because that's where that picture that you draw of him struggling over a problem with his writing, that sort of forms the background to the whole piece.
Yeah, it begins. You see, my father was a teacher, so he always had copies to correct. He did the leaving cert. He would do the exam. You know, he would get a big black box from Dublin and you'd have be quiet. Your father's correcting the leaving cert. But he also wrote articles about local history for the local paper and for other papers, so that the memory is him at the table. It's the dining room table. You know, it's not as though he had a study or anything. It's a small house. And his handwriting is indecipherable to me. And he's every time he doesn't like something he's writing, he balls the paper up and throws it across the room, nearly hitting the fireplace, which, of course, is anyone's joy. You know, you don't have to be responsible. And so I'm just thinking about that image of him doing that and me watching him, knowing you to be quiet and sort of watching him writing and having his notes and thinking, that's what I'm doing. That's funny. But he died when I was 12, so I don't have memories of, you know, coming home with long hair or coming home from Dublin with funny attitudes or, you know, losing my religion. I didn't have those arguments. And then I was thinking about fathers and sons and thinking the most unlikely, you know, are there, with writers, is instead of the Oedipal thing, is there a writer who loved his father, who was a mild and honourable man, and they got on famously? And oddly enough, Samuel Beckett. And
that's incredible.
That's,
I mean,
a
it sounded
story.
Like a friendship between two men,
they,
the walks they
loved
had together.
Walking out of Dublin, going south, going towards the mountains, like all the and at Glastool, you know, going beyond Glastool, Ballynagh and all that. And they would walk on for a whole day. And sometimes talk and sometimes not. Mm-hmm. But it was no strain and no father telling Sam, it's about time you got a job. I mean, his mother did that later. But his father never said, what's this French rubbish? Why don't you get a proper job? And in a way, the Becketts produced, and often, well, in generations, produced an artist and a quantity surveyor. In each generation, it's everyone's dream, isn't it, to have two kids, one the
artist
and one
the quantity
surveyor.
But there you go, you're ticking
all
the boxes.
And so it's a sort of beautiful story. It's, it's one of those very unexpected stories.
And you roll the paper up and fire it across the room.
I like my father, I work in longhand.
Do you?
I think my handwriting is more decipherable than his, but I might be wrong about that because I was a kid watching him. No, I will just put a mark through. I write in notebooks, so it's quite hard to pull the page
out.
But I do cross out.
You're self-limiting. You can't rip the page out.
Yeah.
And you say at the end of that that there's so much left to say. I mean, clearly you would have loved the opportunity to have a longer relationship.
With anyone whose parents die, either parents die when you're younger, you think, wow, I'm not going to be able to explain this, or I'm not going to be able to tell them that. And yeah, that's part of grief.
And then Enlarge the Light, which is at the end of the book. I mean, your appreciation of art is deep. I mean, your description of standing, looking at a painting for hours and hours and hours because you felt this deep responsibility because you were asked to write about it.
Yeah. If you go into the National Gallery now, there's a wonderful room where the Irish painters of the 20th century, or the second half of the 20th century, are there. And it's strange getting older where I knew Louis Le Brocque, I knew Patrick Collins, I knew Patrick Scott. I didn't know them well, but I spoke to them. And there is their work on the wall in this canonical place, you know, which is the, I suppose, the Mecca in Ireland.
Isn't that so strange, though? I mean, I find this, in the rare occasion, on the rare occasion, when a friend of mine writes a book, I find it really hard. It takes me about a year to sit down and read that book. I find it uncomfortable for some reason. Is it the same with you and the artist?
I find writing about painting great because it means I have to go into detail because I don't have a theory of it. The only thing I can do is to say there's a brushstroke coming down to the left that could be a shadow or could in fact lead us somewhere else. It's a mixture of sort of brown and orange, but you can see, you know, I just love actually standing in front of a painting with a notebook. Because I think with those paintings, the more you look, the more you get.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's true in the National Gallery, that just time on your own. And also in Ireland, because it's free, you just walk in.
And stay as long as you like.
You can stay half an hour. You know, it's.
But is the experience different if you know the artist?
I think the experience is different if you've looked a lot at work by the painter, or you just even going in to look at the Vermeer. And I certainly didn't know him, but the feeling of that girl reading the letter, is such a familiar image yes. now that the more you look at it, the more you get. Mm-hmm. So I think that question of looking and looking and looking and just not trying to make sense of something as much as trying to get more pleasure or deeper understanding. And mm-hmm. yeah, so in a way, this was, I suppose, a freedom in this book that I could write about paintings without feeling, you know, trying to get the piece into a newspaper. I think that's the great thing about the internet, that the blog just was a blog. We weren't looking for advertising.
There's a great freedom to it,
isn't it? Yeah, we weren't looking for anything other than if you want to read this, here it is, it's free.
Mm-hmm.
And so it allowed me to go into galleries. And I think the fact that the internet is so competitive, there's so many things you could read on that, trying to then make your piece as good as possible to hold the reader's attention on the basis of so much else you could do. Just by a click.
Yeah, we have very many choices. And Eileen Gray, I wanted to talk to you about Eileen because it's clear that you have such an admiration for her and you feel that she's still underappreciated.
I mean, I'm sure there have been stamps, but I suppose what I wanted was Wexford, County Wexford, that is so good at commemorating things, so good at commemorating the rebellion of 1798, the rebellion of 1916, so good at commemorating the Wexford team, that in some prominent place in Wexford, especially in the town of Enniscorthy, which is where she was from, that there would be something absolutely beautiful as a monument. That people would come and look at the monument itself to Eileen Gray and her achievement. And because she was one of the great designers. And while a lot of men took a lot of responsibility, for example, Corbusier and all those French guys, but actually she was the one who was working on that house first, that famous house in the south of France. And also anyone who sees her furniture thinks, she spent her time trying to work out, if I put the window there, it will get light at 5 o'clock. But what if I want to read at noon? What window would that be? And it's that whole idea of building a house around ideas of light, which is something, if you just look sometimes at the way a bungalow is plonked, on into the landscape, or even the way we design housing estates, that there isn't enough attention paid to how the light will slant or how the light will be, even in a small, modest house.
Mm-hmm, which is so important for our well-being to consider the light, isn't it?
Yeah. I think so.
And you were fascinated too by how upset she was at the disruption caused to her home place in Wexford.
I wonder if in a lot of our lives, the thing that might matter most is some disruption. Is the leaving home in a way that was disruptive, or losing a relative in a way that's disruptive, and that you get, it wakes you up in some way. Mm-hmm. I think with a lot of writers, you find that there is something there that is unresolved. For her, it was an extraordinary idea. She was brought up in a beautiful Georgian country house close to the River Slaney outside Enniscorthy. And her father decided, I don't know what he was thinking about, she doesn't either, to make it a mock Tudor house instead. To get all these builders in and to put all these angles and strange Gothic looks and ruin the whole beautiful, those Georgian windows,
yes.
the I suppose the austerity of it, and to make it all fussy and mad. And all her life, she regretted it. Even in her tour 90, she would go on about that house was so destroyed.
Well, it kept her away as well. Yeah, she didn't like to come home.
Didn't like to come home. But also, in a way, she was born in an earlier Ireland. You know that she was highly Anglo. She was Anglo, and a lot of people like that didn't come back as often. It wasn't like coming home from America to your family in Enniscorthy.
You were gone.
But she always regretted that plain house had been ruined by this fussy house, and in a way, her design. And her furniture was one way of getting back at the designers of the fussy house to try and make austere shapes and interesting look for things.
Well, there's still plenty of time now for Wexford to appreciate.
Yeah, I hope they're listening.
Eileen Gray, how's America at the moment?
Things are looking up. In November, there will be two elections. One is Mamdani in New York. And I don't know if anyone's been following Mamdani, but yes, I suggest you do, because it's tremendously cheering. He is this wonderful guy. He's 33 years old. His father teaches at Columbia. He's from a reasonably, I suppose, privileged background. And he's a socialist. And he answers questions straight when he was asked, what would you do as mayor if Netanyahu came to New York? He said, I'd have him arrested. he's winning, and he's talking seriously about things that matter to people, such as bus fares, such as grocery prices, such as your apartment price. So It's likely he's going to win, and that will be a wonderful moment in November when Mamdani will stand up as the mayor of New York, having been elected, by, I think, by some sort of landslide. The second one is more interesting. It's actually Gavin Newsom is doing a referendum on the 4th of November. In California, you have to have a referendum to gerrymander. And he's saying we don't want to gerrymander. They gerrymandered. If we let them continue to gerrymander in Texas, he will have to win Congress, Trump, in next year's midterm elections, which normally go against the sitting president. And it's vital that the Democrats win the midterm elections next year. But this November, this is going to be a referendum. Effectively, it's a referendum on Trump. Mm. And it's California. And the hope is that California will just come out in massive numbers. So two elections, one will matter. It will be the mayor of New York, a socialist mayor of New York, and the other. And he's not running against Trump. It's a lesson to the Democrats. He's not against Trump. He's for cheaper bus fares. He's for better groceries. He's for rent control. Mm-hmm. He's for things. And he's brushing Trump aside. November is possible. We'll all be more cheerful
in December.
We were
talking about Gavin Newsom on the programme last week with Marion McCone. And so I went down this rabbit hole where I watched him on a podcast, Diary of a CEO, which was nearly 2 hours long. But he's fascinating, isn't he? He is like a movie star, but he's like a movie star who's acting, but knows exactly which buttons to press as you watch him. And he's a classic politician, isn't he?
Yeah, if Mamdani is a glamorous socialist, then Gavin Newsom is a glamorous capitalist. And he's absolutely right. He's Silicon Valley. You know, he's talking about the size of the Californian economy. So he's not radical, except he's saying this country is being stolen from us in front of our noses. Wake up. And he says this, wake up, very well. Wake up, everybody. So he seems like someone who in any other society would be just a normal, pretty right-wing Democrat governor of California. But no one can be pretty ordinary under these circumstances, mm-hmm. because anyone who has read history knows this is how Hitler took power. Slowly, paranoid, sending troops into cities that don't need the troops, saying there's danger everywhere when there isn't danger, picking people up off the streets. I mean, the ICE stuff in California is beyond belief. I had a friend who had a guy just doing odd jobs for him. He would normally get the material himself in the morning and bring the material to work. It's a normal way, since things are so far away from each other in California. The guy just said innocently one day, I won't be able to bring the material. And my friend said, why? Well, we can't go to the hardware shops. The ICE watch the hardware shops in California because that's really where the undocumented go, because they're all, a lot of people are doing odd jobs, mm-hmm. and they pick them up there.
That's
and the problem
disguised.
Is they pick them up and no one can find them. I mean, this is disappearing people. And so, things are very bad. November is I'm talking about things being good because there's a possibility of two elections in November that will really matter. In the meantime, Trump has all the power.
But like the Democrats were in such shock, weren't they, after the election? And actually, it was from this time last year, wasn't it, when Joe Biden had to step aside? Mm-hmm. And it has taken them an awful long time to be shaken out of that stupor. But you're saying you feel that it's happening now.
Well, you see, the problem is that it's not like the British or Irish systems where there's a leader automatically elected and that person leads the Democrats. I mean, the Democrats are made up of so many different groups and different, in a way, different sort of textures of belief. Mm-hmm. But these two figures, Mamdani and Gavin Newsom, have something going for them in that they're articulate and they're also arguing something that people are listening to. By the way, they're both using Facebook and Instagram brilliantly. Like they're on those things. Mamdani makes a video twice a day. He just, if anything occurs to him, he makes a video and it's out. And Gavin Newsom is starting to do the same.
He's
doing
trolling
Mamdani,
isn't he?
He's laughing at that big lump.
Mm-hmm. But then on the other side, you have J.D. Vance. You know, they have their succession plan ready on the Republican side too.
Yeah, but I don't think J.D. Vance is the same danger, the same daily business of wanting to do something to control the news cycle for 24 hours, which is what Trump tries to do every morning. And then the idea that he's been pushed very far by his own instincts and by others to go against all democratic norms. The rule of law, for example, the safety of people on the streets, the entire business of foreign relations. J.D. Vance is not as mad. But I mean, when I say Trump is mad, I mean he's deliberate and serious about undermining and effectively destroying American democracy. And it was lovely. I thought the idea, I don't know what religion you are, but I was brought up as a Catholic. And the idea that you would say to the Pope who's ailing, I'll pray for you. No, the Pope does the praying. You say nothing. But the idea of J.D. Vance, who's just become a Catholic, 2019, arriving in the Vatican with all these rosary beads and telling the Pope he'll pray for him.
Mm-hmm. But they welcomed him and he got on famously, himself and his wife, Usha, isn't it? And their three children. It was an extraordinary moment, though. Colm, I could talk to you all day, but I'm going to get in trouble if I keep going because we've other things to do. I have another book of yours in my hand called A Long Winter, which is out now as well, is it?
Yeah, it's a story from a book of stories from years back that I always liked, and we thought we'd bring it out as a book on its own.
It's lovely. Yeah, it's a beautiful, again, a beautiful looking book. And the other one is Ship in Full Sail.
I mean, Ship in Full Sail really looks beautiful, doesn't it?
It does. It looks gorgeous.
I'm so proud of it.
It looks gorgeous, and it's a lovely book, and I enjoyed it immensely, and I always enjoy having you with us. We will be back after this break.
Thank you.
Get in touch on WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32.